Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
I must tell you, Nancy, I thoroughly enjoyed the entire experience. I felt like I was just having a casual conversation with an old friend. So it was quite enjoyable.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. Today's mentor guest is Dr. Cedric Bryant of the American Council on Exercise, known as ACE. I invited Dr. Bryant into this conversation to discuss his journey as an innovator and thought leader and how he is on the move innovating in the health and fitness arena. Hi, Cedric.
Hi, Nancy. How are you?
I'm great. How are you feeling today?
Oh, I feel great. It's sun shining here in Seattle, and we've been under some gray skies, so it always seems to have a positive effect on the mood when you see the sun out.
Nice, nice. So Cedric is the president and chief science officer of the American Council on Exercise, and ACE Fitness is a leading nonprofit exercise professional and health coach certification organization. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Their goal is to elevate professionals' careers by setting the highest industry standards. The organization helps people around the globe make their mission movement. Dr. Bryant develops strategies that deliver exercise science and behavior change education in engaging and compelling ways. Over 90,000 people have become exercise professionals and health coaches equipped to evolve their respective fields. Dr. Bryant's academic achievements includes earning a doctorate in physiology and a master's degree in exercise science from Pennsylvania State University. He received the Penn State Alumni Recognition, Alumni Fellow, Board of Trustees Distinguished Alumni Awards. The Distinguished Alumni Award is the school's highest alumni honor given to select alumni who are considered leaders in their professional fields. So welcome to the program, and I'm excited to kind of jump in to a little bit of your background. I was wondering, what does FACSM stand for? It's an acronym behind your PhD.
Sure. It just signifies that I'm a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. Okay. Okay, so let's get started with kind of how you became so innovative and how did you build out your career as a thought leader? So what was it like growing up in your home? Who was there?
Well, I grew up in a kind of a typical suburban kid in a lot of respects, mother and father and older brother and older sister. And there was a lot of laughter and fun in our household, as well as just kind of a commitment to I would say, education and always putting in what I would call an honest effort in whatever you chose to pursue.
Okay. Oh, cool. And if you picked 4 to 6 words that would describe each your mother and your father, what would they be?
Okay, I'll start with my mom. I would say authentic, in that my mom was the same person regardless of who the audience might be. I would say tenacious. My mom really, we would affectionately refer to her as the little corporal because she was pretty tough, very disciplined. But also I would say quite passionate about caring for her family and loved ones.
That's nice. Okay. And how about your dad?
My dad, I would say my dad was, just the hardest working individual that I've ever observed in my life. And that my dad, there was only one way to do something, that was to do it all out, was the model that my dad provided for me. He was also, I would say, just humble and pretty straightforward. And he was a person that you could count on. You know, if he was going to do something, be somewhere, what have you, he was going to be there, and he's probably going to be there. We joked about it. It's like you never want to have an early morning meeting that my dad was going to take us to, because that meant we would always say it's going to be oh dark 30 that we were going to be there, because he never was late.
Wow. Are they still alive today?
They are both deceased.
Oh, they are. Okay. Yeah. And where, how long ago did they pass away?
My dad in 01 and my mom in 08.
Okay. Yeah. So you've been kind of building your life beyond your parents for quite a while.
Yes, for quite a while now. But fortunately, they're around to see a good chunk of it. And that actually derived a lot of joy for me, because the interesting thing about my parents is that neither finished high school. And so for them to instill a love of education for me was quite, I think, remarkable, given the fact that, you know, their educational experiences were quite limited.
Well, and you went all out like your dad.
Yeah, this model definitely served as some motivation for me.
Yeah, that's right. From no degree to a doctorate. That's amazing. Yeah. Oh, that's really, really cool. And what did you learn about taking financial and emotional risks as a child in your family?
You know, it's funny. I didn't realize that I was learning it at the time, but my parents, they really never stressed about things like, you know, finances and even, you know, kind of those, you know, life happen events. And also just when I kind of learned about their stories and their journeys, and that they were both raised in rural Georgia, and they packed up and came up north because, you know, at the time that was kind of considered the land of opportunity, not really knowing anyone. And to me, that really was just a huge risk and kind of going from really kind of different worlds. And they just through hard work and dedication, you know, made a life for themselves as well as me and my siblings. And I think really probably changed the course of our lives, because I'm not sure what my experiences would have been had they not kind of taken that kind of bold effort to just, you know, launch out and come north, if you will, to that land of opportunity. Cause I remember as a young child, we would go back to where they grew up to visit for the summers. And it was a different world from what I was used to growing up in Teaneck, New Jersey, which is where they moved to, and going down to the deep south, wow. And just kind of the cultural differences, the differences, I think, in terms of opportunity and so forth. So I'm quite thankful that they were the risk takers to kind of branch out and kind of embark on this kind of new journey.
And what kind of careers did they have? What industries were they in?
It was a longshoreman, and my mom was a nurse's aide.
Okay, nurse's aide. And what was it? A longshoreman?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He worked on the docks.
Oh, I see. And so what do you do on the docks?
Well, you basically unload ships and you know, it's just, you know, hard manual labor, but it was a good income for him, given, you know, educational level and so forth. And he was able to, you know, provide for a family and own a home and, you know, do all the things that, quote unquote, you know, one looked for in terms of realizing the American dream.
Yeah, exactly. So were they both doing the same work when they moved from Georgia to New Jersey?
Well, they when they were in Georgia, they were sharecroppers working in the fields. And so it was, that's in terms of kind of that opportunity is to really, you know, get into a career, if you will, in terms of as a longshoreman for my dad.
Wow. And some curiosity to learn a new trade.
Exactly. Yes. And that, again, I think that was part of that. That risk taker. And I don't think my dad viewed it as necessarily being a risk taker, but just as doing what was needed to get done to be able to provide for his family adequately.
Yeah. I think a lot of that's very common with risk takers, right? You don't see it as such a big risk at the time until when you reflect back on it, you think, wow, that was a big risk.
Exactly.
Yeah. So would you describe that as one of the bigger challenges that you experienced growing up? Or were there some others?
It's funny because when I think about challenges and I really, I'm hard pressed to And I'm wondering how much of it was just the way my folks approach things, because I can't recall or perceive things that I thought of as a real challenge, because my folks they just dealt with whatever happened and just worked through it. And so I don't you know, I'm thinking as a child, I didn't view much of anything as a challenge. I think my biggest challenge was, what sporting activity was I going to participate in on a given day?
Okay. So you were big into sports when you were young even, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. In terms of big challenges, usually when we think about trauma, you know, the small traumas that could accumulate over a period of time and then kind of show up at our lives as we kind of reflect on our lives, and the big traumas are events where anyone would find disturbing. It's the way our body and our brain kind of respond to painful experiences. When you think about trauma and challenges in your family, it was the family's approach to how you work through things that you found helpful in addressing your own challenges?
Yes, I would say so, in that I think what was modeled to me by my parents was to not be consumed by whatever you might be facing, but really think in terms of just continuing to move forward, however small that forward movement might be. And eventually you will be able to either overcome or get around whatever the obstacle might be, as opposed to kind of being, I think, stuck in an action.
Yeah.
That you know, we were always kind of, I think, trained to take some action. However small.
Okay. And that sounds like it has served you well throughout your life.
It really has. It really has.
Yeah. So what were you rewarded for and becoming known for in your early adult life?
I would say, can you define early adult life for me?
Like your teens?
In my teens, I would say for combination of athletics and academic achievement.
Okay. And what academic subject matter were you kind of interested in?
I love mathematics and science, but I also, I just love to read, and you know, I will read anything. And I was a joke with my wife and my kids, like, I can't sit down and there could be something in front of me that is some type of reading material where I won't pick it up. It's just, I've always had a love of reading. And so I would say, probably unusual for many young folks, I really didn't have a subject that I didn't like.
Oh, wow. So that makes you very diverse in conversation and talking about anything with anybody.
That's what they say.
Okay, well, that's what I'm learning about you as we're going along here. Very good. So you've got several degrees, as we talked about. So if you've had a wide variety of interests, was it hard to pick out a career academic path?
You know, to some degree, it was, because when I was an undergrad, because my early years, I was playing baseball at Rutgers, which is my undergraduate school. And I think one of the things that is done typically with athletes is that you get funneled into courseware or academic study that it was largely kind of into business is where I got directed, as opposed to, I think there was a hesitancy to have the athletes pursue science with degrees because of the labs would often be conflicts with practice and so forth. And so I was in business, and that was probably the first time that I really was in something that, while I did fine, I just really didn't enjoy it. It wasn't something that I was truly passionate about. And it wasn't until my junior year when I took an elective course in physiology that I really found my spark and my passion. And so that led me, I think, down the path of kind of pursuing what eventually became my career.
Hmm.
And the one thing I would encourage any young person to do, a person of any age, is to be true to who you are and pursue those God-given passions, because I think we have those for a reason. And you know, oftentimes you hear people say that, I feel like I've never worked a day in my life. And I think it's those individuals who pursue their God-given passions are the ones who are able to say that, versus those who are miserable every day going to work.
Mm-hmm. And when did you realize that you were an innovator?
Well, you know, it's funny. I laugh when you refer to me as an innovator, because I wouldn't necessarily think of myself in that fashion, but other people have referred to me in that manner as well. And I think part of what has served me in being a quote unquote innovator is there, again, I think the model that my parents gave me, in that you don't have to fear the quote unquote failure. In terms of, I think to be an innovator, you've got to be comfortable with things not always turning out as planned, and being able to adjust and adapt and move forward. And so I think that's probably been the biggest character trait that's helped me in terms of being an innovator, is not being afraid to try things and not have them go as planned, but also not to sweat it if it doesn't, but just realize it's a learning opportunity, learn what I can and move on to the next opportunity. And I think that really is a key and fundamental part of being an innovator, is that you've got to be able to, I think, fail fast, if you will.
Yeah.
And pivot and make an adjustment, learn what you can, and continue to move forward.
Exactly. Peter F. Drucker has had a long history in innovation and management, and is a huge guru, has written eight volumes. Last year, there was a Harvard Business Review reissued 8 of his books, and they call it the Drucker Library.
Yes.
And I thought it would be good to work from, the definition of how Drucker defined innovation is as the task of endowing human and material resources with new and greater wealth-producing capacity. And I kind of noticed that with what you've built with ACE. And we can talk a little bit about that too. The large organization has to learn to innovate or it will not survive. And managers must convert society's needs into opportunities for a profitable business. That also is innovation. And that innovation is not invention. Innovation is a term of economics rather than technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what he talks about in innovation are 5 little things that are are kind of big things, but one is to analyze the sources of innovation for opportunities. Second is to determine the customer needs, wants, and expectations. And mm-hmm. I know that you're probably going to talk about some of these things because you don't certify 90,000 people without, you know, knowing that there's a need out there. Mm-hmm. The third is innovation should be simple and focused. It should start small. And the fifth is innovation should aim at leadership. So it always starts, and that's why I focus with self-leadership, is asserting your journey as an entrepreneur and an innovator in continuing your learning. And you've got this really rock solid foundation that you've been building on that you're getting a lot of momentum from. So I just wanted to acknowledge you for that. And do you want to talk to any of those things that I discussed with innovation that seemed to resonate with you?
Sure. I would say actually all five do, in terms of, because I think, to me, analyzing is really kind of taking a step back and really trying to understand the current landscape so you can identify what I call are kind of the problems, which really translates into opportunities mm-hmm. for innovation as you develop those solutions. And I think that's where understanding what your customers' needs and wants or even their pain points are what oftentimes presents those innovative opportunities. And I also like the fact that he talked about them being simple and that most of the most kind of lasting and sustaining innovations are those that are the most simple and straightforward solutions to a defined problem that affects a large number of folks.
Yeah, and he also talks about, too, like if we're looking at an opportunity to say, what do people need now? Mm-hmm. And even if you're building technology for down the road, it's still you're finding a solution of something that you experienced as an opportunity in that window of opportunity.
Yes.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about, you got your 2 degrees, your master's and your doctorate in Pennsylvania. What was the criteria that made you decide to plant your feet in Pennsylvania and stay there for a while?
Well, it's funny in that I was, I think that's where kind of mentoring and really taking the advice of others. I was at Rutgers, and one of the professors there had recommended Penn State as being a great program for exercise physiology and applied physiology, because understanding my love of athletics and sport, as well as my growing interest and love of physiology, that it would kind of serve as a nice blend of those loves and passions that I had. And he was 100% correct. And so when I went to Penn State, I was thinking, because I'd never even thought in terms of a doctorate as an undergraduate. I was just thinking, okay, I'll go get my master's. And I was thinking that I'd work in cardiac rehabilitation because I always had an interest in, the cardiovascular system and health, largely because of thinking about some of the health issues that seem to be pervasive in my immediate as well as extended family in terms of hypertension and heart disease and so forth. So I was thinking that I would get a master's and go to work in cardiac rehab where I could have an impact there. And as I got matriculated into Penn State and learned more and more, I just, again, I think that thirst that I have for learning and growing just kept growing. And then my master's advisor said, you're a great student. And I was doing some TA work for him, teaching classes and so forth. He goes, have you ever thought about pursuing your PhD? And that really is what planted the seed for me to go on and stay and get my doctorate.
Mm. So someone planted the seed. And what was your dissertation focused on?
My dissertation was focused on looking at non-pharmacologic means for managing hypertension and physical activity or exercise being one of those, and really trying to identify through what mechanisms the beneficial effects were happening, and really kind of focusing on the sympathetic nervous system and regulating the tone of the sympathetic nervous system, which is kind of that fight or flight aspect of the nervous system, in terms of helping to modulate or control one's blood pressure.
Wow. All right. And tell us a little bit more about then, after you defended your dissertation, where did you go next?
Next, I went to Arizona State and joined the faculty there. While there, I got involved in doing research. I was, teaching, of course, and also doing research, looking at using exercise as a way to help improve the functional capabilities of individuals who were afflicted with peripheral vascular disease, which is basically kind of the analog of having coronary vascular disease, but having it in the extremities, and those individuals would find it very difficult and painful to walk for really any length of time or distance, and so it really impairs the quality of life. And so that's, as I was researching that, we were looking at different modalities, and I did some research with Stairmaster, which was a hot exercise product.
Oh, yeah.
And looking at modifying one of the Stairmaster's steppers so that it could go at a lower enough intensity for that patient population to see if it would have beneficial effects in improving their functional capabilities. And as a result of that, I reconnected with a colleague of mine who I worked with when I was on the faculty at West Point. He was involved with Stairmaster, and through that research work, I got connected there, and that really led to kind of the next step in my journey, in that I left Arizona State and joined Stairmaster, working in their research and development group, and actually eventually became senior VP of research and development for Stairmaster, which preceded my moving on to joining the American Council on Exercise in 2001.
Okay. So you have been there since 2001. Are you still connected with Stairmaster?
I was at Stairmaster from 1991 to 2001. And then, so my career has kind of been in thirds. First third was kind of the traditional academic route, teaching and doing research at Penn State, West Point, and Arizona State, those three institutions. And then the middle third was working in R&D for Stairmaster, the exercise equipment company. And then this, what I'm calling my final third, is work with the American Council on Exercise.
Well, and that must have opened up a whole new arena for you in being able to train people to do what you've discovered.
Yes, and I think when you kind of think about your why, if you will, the Simon Sinek, what's your why?
Yeah.
And when I think about my why, I would say I'm a coach at heart. I love investing in others, kind of cheering them on, helping motivate them to reach their full potential. And when I look back at my life, it's clearly reflected in my personal and professional life. Being the dad of four sons, coaching hundreds, if not over 1,000 athletes of all ages and in multiple sports, kind of coaching and mentoring my students and my staff throughout my career, coaching and educating the exercise professionals and health coaches that we have the privilege of having a relationship with at ACE, I derive the most pleasure and joy and rewards from helping as many people as possible reach their full potential, whether that's, you know, health and wellness, whether it's their professional development, whether it's their personal development. That's what really gets me really fired up is being able to see that growth in others.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Right. You're passing on all this mentoring and coaching and building out a whole infrastructure on the American Council on Exercise. So since you've been on board, you've really, it looks like the numbers have really blown up with the amount of certification that you are doing. I mean, over 90,000 people around the world.
We've been fortunate, and just to be clear, it's not just because of me.
Of course,
I am blessed that I get to work with a team of great individuals who are members of our executive team, as well as the rest of our organization that are all just mission oriented individuals who are committed to, you know, helping us fulfill that mission to get people moving toward adopting and maintaining healthier lifestyles. And so I just consider myself really blessed that I'm part of a great team.
Yeah. Well, I was just talking with Dr. Amy Bantham, and for our conversations, I'm focused. I was really shocked and thought, you know, I just want to spend the month of April really talking about how we need to really move and be a lot more intentional, because, you know, the numbers were pretty low to begin with, of us being like 23%. Of the population fit some of the numbers for cardiovascular health and had to do with weightlifting. And during the pandemic, that number of 23% dropped within that 30%. And that was traded, from my perspective, to screen time. Like, so people are, you know, screen time is up 30% and we've stopped exercising 30% of the time. So what are you seeing from your perspective? How are you digesting all of that with what's going on in our society?
Sure. One of the things, we've been in the midst of what I would say a lack of movement pandemic or physical inactivity pandemic for quite some time now. And the coronavirus pandemic has only exacerbated things. Mm-hmm. And it's taken people out of their normal routines. And we know from behavior sciences that when individuals move out of their normal routines, a lot of things get disrupted. And one of the things that I think for many people have gotten disrupted is their physical activity habits, particularly those individuals who relied on going to exercise facilities as their primary means of meeting their physical activity needs, because many of those places were shut down during the height of the pandemic and so forth. And so, you know, once you get out of that routine, it becomes very difficult to regain that routine or to make that pivot or that shift to other options or opportunities. And that's why organizationally, we've been trying to provide resources for folks who are home wearing multiple hats now as well. Because, you know, if you're a parent at home and you have children at home who are in school, not only are you trying to do your occupational tasks, but you're also kind of part-time educator, you know, trying to make sure that your children have what they need in terms of remote learning and so forth. You're stuck in front of your electronic devices for Zoom meetings, Teams meetings, whatever the media might be. And one of the things that we know is that screen time can be particularly fatiguing. And so when you finish there, many people aren't feeling that energized to go and then be active. And it's kind of counterintuitive in that probably one of the best things you could do is to give yourself a break by getting outside and doing something active, or whether it's, you know, just, you know, going for a walk, you know, going on a hike, you know, what have you. And so we are trying to encourage people with opportunities and also to try to work with communities to be able to make activity more accessible and working in partnership, particularly as we get into the, you know, better part of the year weather-wise, is that we have an initiative called Moving Together Outside, where we're trying to work with the municipalities to be able to, you know, share access to things like parks, schools, and so forth, which can be great gathering places for people to be active and to provide an opportunity for these qualified professionals to lead safe, effective activity experiences in their communities, taking advantage of these areas, given that the club environments aren't as readily accessible because, depending upon the location, some of them are open at very limited capacities. And for some individuals, they're still a little uncomfortable going back to an indoor environment at a club or facility, whereas they might be quite comfortable going to their local park or school or you know, open area to engage in some type of physical activity.
Yeah. We definitely, I'm seeing a lot more people out. And so I think that's why I was kind of shocked that the numbers are so bad. Did you see the numbers drop in how many people you can certify? Like are there less coaches as a result of this time?
No, fortunately for us, our numbers really weren't that affected because we were able to pivot quickly to being able to offer the education and preparation remotely using digital technology, as well as the assessments and so forth. But what is a challenge for those individuals is being able to make a living as effectively as they could, because yeah, health clubs were a big employer of individuals who hold the certifications. And so with that being less of an option and opportunity, since many of them are working at a reduced level and capacity, the need for coaches and exercise professionals to work in those environments has also reduced. And so many of the individuals had to make the kind of pivot or shift to working on their own and taking advantage and leveraging technology as a way to deliver their services. And so part of what we've done to help them in that pivot is to give them the education tools and knowledge and skills to be able to deliver their services remotely using technology to do so.
Yeah. So view their careers more, even more entrepreneurial.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. I'm a yogi and I just teach one class per week, but I'm noticing, you know, I notice the field of yoga has really exploded in the yoga journal community. They've done a ton of training helping yogis go online and teach yoga online. So I'm seeing that will probably stay, although some of the biggest spiritual shifts that I experience are in person. Mm-hmm. With people. So what are you seeing in that area? Do you think that the online training is here to stay? Or do you think that there will be a huge comeback as a result of people, you know, being so isolated that now they like want to bulk up their social calendars and really be a lot more active?
I think what you're going to see is that I think there's going to be a hybrid model going forward. I think there's going to be some level of digital remote options for folks, but I think there is going to be that pent up demand for wanting to have that real life kind of in person contact and connection and community. So I think you're going to see a hybrid. Which I think is a great thing, because I think it just expands the options and opportunity for people, so they have a menu of choices that they can use. And I also, I'm encouraged to hear what you just stated with regard to the field of yoga, because you think about the mental health impact of what we've been experiencing with the pandemic and the mind-body element of yoga. I think I'm encouraged to hear that there's so much activity, because it can really, I think, help a lot of people in terms of kind of dealing with some of the mental stressors that they're experiencing, even if it isn't optimal. Because like you said, I think that in-person experience is where you really get that deep connection. But even being able to have that experience online is a way to help people to better kind of manage their overall kind of psychological and mental health, which I think is huge.
Yeah.
And across the entire age spectrum.
Yeah. Well, I would like to talk with you more about that in a second conversation. Are you up for it?
Absolutely. I could talk about this all day.
Terrific, because I want to dig in a little bit deeper in our second conversation. And I just thank you for this. So are there studies on business owners and their level of activity?
Boy, that is an excellent question, Nancy. And I can't say that I recall any studies really looking at that. That's a great question.
Yeah, because I would just be curious to know myself, are business owners because they're in charge of taking care of everybody, I see them, you know, really stressed and not always taking good care of themselves. And so they're not taking charge of their emotional development in the way that they could under a little bit less stress, or if they're taking care of their needs, they have more space to take care of other people's needs. And we know this, but making the transition with the behaviors, I'm just seeing that business owners are under a lot of pressure and stress to just survive, that they're going to choose either, you know, the financial, what will bring the cash flow. So whatever activity they're doing to generate the cash flow is where their energy is going. And that's where a lot of their energy has been going over the last year, to just stay alive. And I'm just wondering, as a population of individuals who are in charge of a lot of people, are leaders taking less good care of themselves than the general population or not?
I am not aware of any real focused research effort or surveys to try to answer that question. But what you postulate is quite reasonable, that I think kind of given the financial stress that they've been under, and it would only seem logical that their focus is going to be on kind of addressing the here and now as it relates to kind of their balance sheet, if you will, from a financial perspective. And even though they are health and wellness professionals, or at least own businesses that address that, that's probably not their primary focus. And you know what, you have just you spurred a thought for me to at least start a dialogue about kind of raising that to their level of awareness and offering some suggestions on how they might focus on self-care, because I think you're spot on, Nancy.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, it's what I'm seeing. And I'm like, it's just really hard for bosses to take care of themselves sometimes. And even though the movement is there and the focus is there, there's lots of resources. When you've got financial pressure, it's like, you know, cash flow or die. I mean, you're going to go with the cash flow. And then once you get that under control, then it's almost viewed as like a luxury to take care of your mental health and your physical well-being. So anyways, we'll get more into this in our next conversation and see where it takes us.
Sounds great.
Okay. Thank you so much, Cedric, for your insights for today. And it's just enjoyable to kind of understand your perspective as an innovator and a thought leader in moving a huge organization forward during a really difficult period in our history.
Thank you, Nick, for the opportunity.
Okay, great. And thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. And thank you all for tuning in. We'll see you all next week. And get out there and move. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become more effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? This is a dual innovation process. We've been doing this kind of work since 1992, helping small business owners and emerging entrepreneurial leaders with self-leadership mastery, business ownership success, and that leads to life success. We focus on the dual innovation journey of reinventing yourself as you redesign your business. We do this with one-on-one strategic mentoring sessions. We have several types of labs that you can participate in with your other peers. Both our entrepreneurial leadership and mentoring lab, which you can really get into the crux of how to run your business more effectively and become more competent. We have meaningful conversations that help with developing a culture that will work for you. I do weekly meditation and yoga that you can participate in to evolve yourself as you redesign your business. You can also sponsor this podcast. We're always looking for people to support our programming, build out our programming with us, and I especially love promoting you. You can get involved in all those different areas because when we mentor, you design a better life, a more fulfilling future as an entrepreneurial leader slash innovator, as a competent business owner slash practitioner, as a mentor slash role model, and as a human being and master of self. Every client starts with a desire to shift something, clarify something, overcome challenges, grow profitability. We started with one entrepreneur. We've mentored thousands. We're ready to work with you. When you show up, we're here. So to get started, go to wementor.com. You can also call me at 612-804-8920, or you can reach me through email, nancy@wementor.com. Get ready and take the next step today.